We're going to move on to another group of patients that I'm sure all of us have faced and continue to face, and that's our geriatric patient. And Dr. Travis Webb is going to come up and give us some caveats about managing their pain.
Good morning. I have to say, this is a much larger crowd than I expected. This is great. It's also a little bit troubling. I know why you're all here. Because this is a very challenging situation, taking care of patients, managing pain. I will say that about 20 years ago, I became a drug dealer. I started writing prescriptions for Percocet, like many of you, just throwing it out like candy because that's what I was told to do. My, how times have changed, though. And hopefully we've all gotten out of that typical routine of just giving drugs, giving opioids to our patients just because that's what we're expected to do, that's what everybody else is doing. I want to talk to you about specifically a patient population, the geriatric patient population. Dr. Weigelt, probably about 16 years ago, encouraged me to start working on how to manage the geriatric trauma and emergency general surgery patient. And over the years, I guess I figured out why. As Dr. Weigelt was looking towards the future, thinking, who's going to take care of me? Very selfish, but that's okay. So for a number of years, I've become much more interested in looking at geriatric population. Specifically, I do acute care surgery, trauma critical care, and emergency general surgery. And so we're frequently taking care of patients coming in, whether requiring surgical interventions or a lot of our trauma patients. That's the vast majority, actually, of our overall trauma patient population is the elderly individual who falls and breaks some ribs. So I'm sure that my practice is similar to at least some of you out there, and trying to figure out the best approach to manage these patients and to limit opioids and to limit the side effects that come with the managing of these patients, I think is extremely important. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that our geriatric patient population brings to us. We're going to describe the key aspects of the preoperative assessment of pain, describe the overall, it's a very simple overall general approach, and the principles of initiating pain management, specifically with opioids, and then describe some of the options that we can use and also mention the medications that we definitely want to avoid. So why should we care about pain management in our elderly population? Well, first of all, it's very common. I look out in the crowd, and I'm not going to say that any of you are old, but I suspect several of you have some pain right now. And I can kind of see it on your face. But the reality is that pain is very prevalent, especially in our geriatric population. It's often undertreated. The undertreatment then can lead to various morbidity, just like overtreatment. So we always worry about, especially in the hospital, we're always thinking about, well, if I give too much pain medicine to somebody, they're going to have respiratory depression. All of a sudden, they're going to be asleep and non-arousable. Code will be called. They'll be sent to the ICU. But the reality is that undertreatment also causes problems, more on a chronic, in the chronic setting. But we have to be thinking about these undertreatment issues. Undertreatment of pain leads to sleep disturbance. Now start ticking these off as far as which ones you're having right now. Sleep disturbance, functional decline. You're not out doing the things that you want to do. Depression and anxiety may lead to polypharmacy, using all sorts of other various medications to try to treat your pain. Malnutrition. So if you're not feeling well, a lot of times you just don't have much of an appetite. Our elderly folks will end up worsening their anorexia and losing weight. When they're in the hospital, undertreatment of pain leads to prolonged length of stay. Patients will stick around and not get up and not get out of the hospital. Once they do get out of the hospital, undertreated pain leads to repeat visits back to either the emergency room or to your clinic. And finally, it can lead to lawsuits. And so this undertreatment needs to be recognized, and the signs and symptoms need to be identified. There are many patient factors that lead to this undertreatment. A lot of pain is ignored. A lot of elderly folks, like I said, will have some sorts of chronic pain, and they just figure, well, I'm just going to kind of keep plugging away, and even though it's difficult to get out of bed today, I'm sure it'll be okay. And they ignore when things actually become more severe. There is a fear of opioids. Now, I think we're getting to the point now where we're all starting to fear them a little bit. But there is this underlying fear, and so again, fear of going to the physician and thinking that they're just going to get some sort of an opioid may lead them, again, to not come to the clinic, not to be seen. Fear of addiction, again. We know that addiction certainly can occur, and we talk about this, but very short duration of opioids is pretty safe. And so in our surgical management, our post-operative management, we're not going to get rid of opioids all the way. Fear of the fact that once you start taking the medication, when I really need it, it's not going to work. The potential that they've been kind of pushed away from managing of their pain by their physician in the past. They've gone to see the doctor, they get ignored, and so, they're not, those doctors, they never do anything for me anyways. And so you have this ongoing undertreatment. Maybe labeled as weak and difficult patient or a complainer. Nobody wants to be a complainer. And then finally, they may have atypical symptoms. So what are some of those atypical symptoms of pain that are being ignored? Things like confusion, restlessness, again, anorexia, aggression, anxiety, fatigue. All of these things may be signs of atypical presentations of pain that unless you're looking for them, unless you're asking about them, then they will be missed. There are also issues from our side, from the provider side, a lack of training in pain assessment and management. That's why we're all here today, and that's why we're talking about it, because we need to better understand what the options are. There certainly are a lot of state and national initiatives. There was a big meeting in the White House yesterday. I was at the meeting, so I didn't get to hear all the details. But certainly there are a lot of initiatives, both at the state and the national, the federal level, looking at how to deal with the opioid crisis. Physicians are also worried about giving opioids to patients, worrying about where those may end up. A lot of times, as you know, pain medicine starts, the abuse of it starts in the home, starts by people who are getting medications from loved ones who have a legitimate reason to have them. And so we're worried about that as physicians. Some of the fear of opioid-related side effects, which could increase the risk of falls and confusion, that's a reasonable risk. And then again, fear of litigation. So when we're considering the preoperative assessment, things that we want to remember, again, chronic pain is very common. So you need to ask about that, and you need to dig into some of those atypical findings and presentations. You need to talk to the family and the caregivers. So I have this saying, maybe I shouldn't say it, but I don't never trust an elderly individual. They will lead you down all sorts of primrose paths. They will smile when they're upset. They don't tell you when they're having a dead gut. They hide appendicitis. And so you have to really take into account what other people tell you as well. I love seeing my elderly folks come into clinic with their loved ones, their spouses. I talk to the elderly individual, and then I kind of glance over at the spouse, and I get the no. So then I open it up a little bit to them and try to find out what the real detail and the real story is. Consider cognitive and sensory defects. So just the fact, the hearing loss issue. A lot of individuals, they will hide it too. They'll nod appropriately, no, yes. But they don't truly hear you. They don't truly understand you. Always be considering whether somebody has cognitive decline, early dementia that's being hidden, that potentially will lead to undertreatment and sometimes overtreatment. And again, look for those atypical symptoms. So the comprehensive pain assessment really should include a whole host of data. You want to ask about the pain presence, the intensity. And I suspect over the course of this morning you've heard about the getting away from the pain scale, but looking more at the functional status. So I always ask, when I'm talking about, say, inguinal hernia pain, I want to know whether it's changing somebody's habits. Have they stopped playing golf? Have they stopped going out for walks? I want to know what truly is how it's truly affecting them. The pain characteristics, the pain physiology. So does this sound more like a nociceptive pain? Is this neurologic pain or nerve pain? Recognizing that can then help you to alter how you're going to manage it. Conditions of the pain behavior, pain treatment, what have they received before? Their coping style, any kind of sensory components to this, and then again, the proxy reports, in other words, family, loved ones, other people, sometimes it's nursing care that can give you a much better idea of what's really going on. Now, the guidelines here for pain management in the elderly are fairly simple. And of course, that means it's never truly as easy as this would make it out to be. But the step one, so these are the WHO guidelines, and you want to basically classify your pain into the mild, moderate, and severe. Starting with non-opioids, NSAIDs, acetaminophen, as you get into the moderate pain, which is more what we commonly deal with from a surgical standpoint, start thinking about the introduction of combined opioids. And then for severe pain, you can see here morphine, oxycodone, hydromorphone. All of these you should be thinking about prescribing, utilizing in a self-limited fashion, however. And I very strongly believe in multimodal therapy. And it amazes me how often I go and round on individuals, say with rib fractures or post-operative hernia repair, and I ask about something very simple. Have they applied, are you using an ice pack? And the residents and the students look at me like, boy, that's too simple. We can't do that. I can't really, there's no prescription for that. Use multimodal therapy. Let me tell you another story. I just had a patient in the hospital last week that was in with abdominal pain from ischemic bowel. Her pain was pretty significant. It was ongoing, and the thing that made the biggest difference, you'll never guess. The thing that made the biggest difference was her grandson came to visit her. When her grandson came to visit her, all of a sudden her pain was almost gone. Now that you'd say, well, that's crazy talk. But there is a huge psychological component to pain, and recognizing that and dealing with that through whether it's music therapy, relaxation therapy, mindfulness training, it helps. It does truly help. And so thinking about those, not completely dismissing them, trying to be patient-centered is going to improve your outcomes. When you're initiating therapy with opioids in particular, really any drug in the elderly individuals, you want to start low and go slow. So like I said, the general principle is pretty darn easy. So start low, go slow. With opioids, start off with about 25 to 50% of the recommended adult dose and titrate. You know, heaven forbid we actually have to go back and reassess our patient. Go back and figure out whether the strategy that you're utilizing is working, and if it's not, make some changes. Recognize that time of onset for elderly individuals is typically pretty similar to younger individuals, but there may be a prolonged effect. And so keeping that in mind as you are treating your patients will be important. Some drugs to avoid: meperidine, Demerol, the mixed agonist-antagonist you want to avoid as well. Propoxifene, Darvocet, I don't think anybody's using anymore, not really available. And then ketorolac. Now, this is one of those that you're like, well, gosh, that's such a great drug. It is kind of a good drug, but probably not in our elderly individuals. And when you look at the beers list, and I would encourage you all to just Google beers list. You'll find it. And it hopefully will not come up with local craft beers, although it may here in Boston. I'm not sure. But if you type in beers list, you will get a nice listing of drugs to avoid in our elderly individuals due to the potential side effects that you'll see. Ketorolac, again, is one of those drugs that there's a significant risk of GI bleeding in particular, and so typically we are told to avoid those. Now, delirium, this is a very common problem in our elderly population, and it is worsened with opioids. Oh, this is a challenge. I don't think we have a great answer to this. Sometimes somebody smarter than me will. But certainly consider decreasing your drugs overall. Decrease your opioid by 25%. Perhaps change the opioid preparation that you're utilizing. The use of something such as haloperidol to treat the delirium may help. And then again, figuring out whether or not you are truly optimizing the non-opioid pain management may get you out of trouble. So in summary, you need to recognize that pain prevalence in the elderly is very common and that it very commonly will present with atypical findings. So it's not just the typical 30-year-old guy who comes in holding his groin saying, I'm in pain. Those are the worst. The geriatric patients, they come in with other typical or atypical types of findings. Tailor the therapy to the individual. So hopefully long gone are the days of just the reflex writing of the Percocet script, but you're thinking more of the individual and can tailor your therapy to them. Avoid those harmful drugs and be aware of drug-drug interactions. And then finally, start low and go slow. That's all I have. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, when we put this together, we figured, I actually figured that there would be a good crowd because of the topic. And our goal was to try to give you some highlights, some principles in our talks, but to really give you enough time to ask questions, since we obviously don't know what you're actually thinking and what your perception of your problems in this area are. So we've got plenty of time for questions. I'm going to turn it over to my co-moderator, Dr. Phyllis, and he's going to answer all your questions, and we'll all leave.
So my name is Cornelius Teals. I'm one of the co-moderators, privileged of being here. I'm actually a general surgery chief resident at Mayo Clinic and did surgical outcomes fellowships, and I really focus on developing guidelines. That's kind of my background. But I first want to thank, obviously, the panelists for coming out today, but especially the audience for staying late. The good thing about being the last session is we can have all day for questions since nobody's in a hurry to leave. But luckily, we do have some time. I have some scenarios if anybody runs out of questions, but otherwise, hopefully, there'll be enough questions to fill the time.
Yes, I was wondering if the panel can comment on perioperative analgesic management in the patients who are on methadone or suboxone maintenance, both in the elective and the emergent settings.
We often defer to our anesthesiologist in this setting, so.
I'm going to try and subdivide it a little bit. So if you look at the methadone patient, right, somebody who's on methadone maintenance falls in the category that Carolyn was talking about. They're opioid tolerant. They're going to have an increased requirement. You need to maintain that dosing, and you can convert from an oral preparation to an IV preparation. You can just do a mathematical calculation knowing that as you move higher on the doses of methadone, the math gets a little bit different. So work with a pharmacist if at all possible, and then expect that your dosing is going to be higher, and then the other general principles of multimodal therapy still apply. Right. If you're using buprenorphine, just pure buprenorphine, it's an agonist antagonist drug. It has a ceiling effect. It has a very long half-life of around 37 hours. So if somebody's got it on board, it's not going to go away immediately. The only way you're going to be able to address it, if it's a minor surgical procedure and it's elective, you may be able to just continue the Suboxone or the buprenorphine around the time of surgery. You may be able to increase the dose slightly and then use other non-opioid analgesics. If it becomes a major operation, maintain it up until the time that they come in the hospital. Once you get in the hospital, you're probably going to have to use high-potency opioids. You may need to use hydromorphone or fentanyl to actually overcome that kind of ceiling effect from the agonist-antagonist. If they're taking Suboxone, now you have naloxone on board, especially if it's somebody who's gotten implanted. So there is a 30-day Suboxone implant, and if they come in and they have that, you're going to battle the whole time. Okay? But again, it's going to be using high-potency opioids and in doses that you're probably not going to be entirely comfortable with. So if you can have other non-opioid approaches, whether it be nonsteroidals, acetaminophen, regional blocks, local anesthetics, ice, all the other things, use those to their best efficacy. But it's a challenge.
Would you ever take the implant out if you're anticipating a major procedure?
If you had somebody with Suboxone in and I knew it was coming ahead of time, I would definitely work on getting it out.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Derek Collier from Nashville. I wanted to ask if in your clinical practice or have you come across any data on what happens to patients once they go through the ICU? And I ask that because I work as a traveling intensivist and I'm convincing nurses that the 90s are over and everybody doesn't need to be on a fentanyl Versed drip of 200 an hour. And I wonder if when you see the patients post-op, those that have been in the ICU, do they have higher opioid requirements than you would otherwise expect?
I guess I'll take that. My answer is no, but we spend a lot of time talking about opioid dosing and combination drug use in the ICU. And just like in what we've been talking about for your perioperative patient, we have realized, and I think the critical care world has realized, that we can't just use high-dose opioids and combination benzos and opioids and not get into trouble. So we spend a lot of time trying to keep as low a dose of opioids in our critical care population as possible. The one exception is what you heard Carolyn talk about, and that's one of the more difficult patient populations, is the patient who comes in with a pre-existing opioid use. And she is exactly right that sometimes we're amazed at the amount of opioids we need, or our multimodal therapy, the dosing that we need to control the acute pain while we're still continuing the chronic opioid dosing that they came in on. So it does change practice, no question about it, but I have not. And maybe it's just the way we have approached, but I think all critical care specialists are approaching it the same way, to try to keep that opioid dose as low as possible.
Yeah, I'll just comment from the anesthesia side of things. We know that you can develop acute tolerance. So sometimes we'll use an infusion opioid called remifentanil, right? Very quick on, very quick off. If you use that during an anesthetic, the patients have a markedly increased need for opioid analgesics post-op. So high-dose exposure does cause acute tolerance. So it's something, if you can avoid excessive dosing, there is benefit in terms of the, you know, scope of management for that patient.
Let me climb over the table here. So I don't know any specific data on the question that you're asking, but I will say that we're not doing as good of a job as we need to in limiting the drug use in the ICU. So anybody from Europe here taking care of patients in the ICU? Okay, so I can say whatever I want. I'm just kidding. So I have heard that certainly that in Europe the use of sedatives for patients on the ventilator in some units is zero. Now, you walk through my ICU, and everybody has propofol running. Everybody has a fentanyl drip running. And you have to ask yourself, is that the right thing? And like Dr. Weigelt mentioned, I think we are thinking more and more about it. But there are barriers. There are systemic barriers and cultural barriers, I would suggest, in our ICUs where the nurses, and I'm not ripping on the nurses, but the nurses want the patients safe, which frequently means sedated, riding the ventilator, not moving around. And that's the trap that we run into. And so I think that certainly starting to address that in the ICUs is there's some legs there for some improvement.
Hi, Nora Chung, Lee Medical Center. For those of you who are using preoperative gabapentin or Lyrica, at what dose do you start it, when do you start it, and how long do you intend it for?
You know, the dosing, depending upon which agent you use, whether you're using gabapentin or Lyrica or whichever, a little bit different. So usually I communicate with the anesthesiologist. And I, you know, as the attending, I'm not writing the dosing so much, so I can't give you an exact number. But usually it's given in the preoperative, in the pre-op holding area. Is where we start it. I mean, I'm not giving it 3 or 5 days in advance, and then we will continue it for a few days post-operatively. And then during that period of time, we're using the other agents, the ice pack, and then stepping down on the opioids. And as we can come off things as quickly as possible, that's what we try to do. But it's just hitting from all different angles to try to reduce the opioid use. So it's just in the pre-op holding areas where it's first administered and then carried on for a few days post-operatively. I don't know if anybody else has any other
doses. The published literature will contain doses from 300 to 1,200 milligrams. The higher the dose, the more they're going to be sedated. So I don't think there's any increase in efficacy when you go from 600 to 1,200, but there's a big increase in sedation. So, you know, using low to moderate doses is a very reasonable thing, and then starting at pre-op, just as discussed, is appropriate.
Hey, I'm Sam Douglas. I'm a chief resident in Birmingham. Love the multimodality. It seems, though, that there's a big fear of using NSAIDs in GI surgery. Can you talk about which NSAIDs you use, Mobic, ibuprofen, what doses you use, and is there something that I can present to my attendings who are a bit older than I am and say, hey, this is
Actually, thank you for asking that question, because about half my practice is pancreatic surgery, and then last year at a national conference, a group from UPMC published a paper that showed that ketorolac was associated with an increase in pancreatic fistula rate when administered perioperatively, and that increase in postoperative pancreatic fistula rate was dose dependent, and so that created quite a concern about us who use it very frequently. It started in the operating room and tried to administer it for at least 48 hours postoperatively. It's one of our biggest agents for reducing opioid use. So we went back and we just did a study where we collected data on 800 pancreatectomies, looked at the dosing, and have tried to come up with something to refute that, because I want to continue to use ketorolac. That's my main agent, and our data showed none of those findings. And I'm in addition, there's now an ACS NISQIP study that is also showing the same findings as us. The concern, of course, was that NSAIDs might be associated with an increase in bowel leaks after surgery, and that's been published as well. So that's why this was looked at. But I think we're still safe to use it. I think it has to be done prospective and randomized in order to say that it's an increased risk. So I don't know that I answered your question, but it's an area that I'm focused on. Yeah, I mean, I think, and I don't know if my colleagues have additional comments, you have to go by the typical contraindication. So if somebody has a history of GI bleed, if somebody has chronic renal insufficiency, you have to be very careful with administering them. But other than that, no, we use them routinely for complex GI surgery.
Yeah, Doug Hengsberger, general surgeon from Ohio. The NSAIDs kind of being on the scary side. what about going full board Scary and hitting the steroids? I've seen, you know, Decadron reducing pain needs in, you know, a number of patients.
One more comment, just that, you know, when we do, sorry, I love this stuff. I became an expert, I guess. So one of the things that we'll use Decadron for, just a small dose to help with postoperative nausea, and a small dose can be associated with a reduced in pain requirement. Also, if you are using the transabdominous plane blocks, administering some Decadron, 4 milligrams, for instance, with the aliquot of the local anesthetic can increase the duration of the effect.
Any comments?
Nope, you're right on target.
Thank you. Next.
Okay, great panel, and I'm Kathleen Hennigan from the ACS. So I just wanted to let everybody know, especially who had gotten those handouts, that the college does have a safe pain control website that includes both patient expectations and questions, as well as professional education. Some of the questions that you even asked, we have some sessions about trauma, ICU, opioid use, long-term safe pain control, all types of things, and they're offered at no charge on that website. You'll also see the college's policy statements that have been going to DC. So very helpful site, and will include also many of these things. And I know that, Dr. Weigelt, you can address that. We'll have this whole, you know, pain modalities, this all series of modules available.
Raul Lugo from South Carolina. I'm going home today, and if I won the $1 billion, this question is irrelevant. But I'm a surgical oncologist, and I'm concerned about DVT. I give all my patients pre-op heparin in the PACU, and then adding antiplatelets like NSAIDs concern me. So is that something I should be concerned about?
Yeah, I think we routinely use it in all patients, in all major cases, colorectal and all complex GI patients. We routinely give heparin pre-op, starting post-op the night of, and we automatically give Toradol, and when they tolerate oral, we switch to NSAIDs, and we've seen no significant increase in bleeds or anything like that. And that's routine practice. There's certainly patients where that's not the case, and you have to go off kind of routine protocol, but as a routine practice, it seems to be safe, at least what we found.
Yeah, they've got an epidural in place. I've got heartburn. Bad.
Hi, Greg Ward, Asheville, North Carolina. I'd like to thank everyone on the panel for excellent and educational and, more importantly, applicable presentations. My question is a little tangential, but I think this is an excellent panel to have insight. You have someone who is narcotic history, abuse, either 3 months or 3 years into recovery, coming in for an elective or emergent surgery. Thoughts on appropriate use of opioids in that patient? Thank you.
Do you want me to talk about that one? Yeah. That's tricky. I think a patient with a history of an actual substance misuse disorder, whether it's opioids or otherwise, clearly are high risk for all of the morbidity that we talked about, you know, relapse of their misuse of substances, you know, new prolonged opioid use, et cetera. I think that's the patient where you kind of pull out all the stops if you have the time and it's elective, and maybe do, you know, a pre-op urine tox screen and, you know, make sure you check the PDMP. I think we didn't talk very much about this, about the application of those opioid risk tools ahead of time, but some people would say really it's just about risk stratification and how intensively do you monitor them. And I think in a patient with a known substance misuse history, you're going to use all of the monitoring tools at your disposal. I think it's a particularly tough line to walk because there's also some data to suggest that poorly controlled pain in an acute pain setting is a risk factor for relapse. So if we, you know, overexpose them, we worry about triggering relapse. But if we underexpose them, we are also probably triggering relapse, because whether it's opioids or otherwise, people will return to their coping substance of choice, to their chemical coping pattern, if they have uncontrolled pain. So broadly, I would, you know, say utox ahead of time, because a patient with any misuse history is at risk of using other illicit substances, and that may change your operative planning if they're actively using illicit substances. Some sort of probably written contract. And I think you engage the patient if they are currently substance-free, they're probably pretty motivated to stay that way and probably have interests that are very aligned with yours in terms of how can we be very thoughtful and intentional about planning this out and setting some landmarks for ourselves, doing everything we can to minimize the opioid use and then try to meet those landmarks with the goal of, you know, getting back to opioid independence. But I would use UTOX, I would use written contract, and just have a real open conversation about the elephant in the room, not just kind of, you know, ignore it and hope that they don't relapse. And just recognize that under-treatment also puts them at risk of relapse.
Yeah. If they've got an addiction specialist that they've been treating with, get them engaged. If they have a partner from Narcotics Anonymous, get them engaged to help them, you know, stay on track so they don't get off plane. And then if you can do non-opioids as your primary approach with a backup, do everything you can to avoid giving them anything that relates to their substance of abuse, if at all possible.
If they want to sort of tolerate more pain and be without opioids, I think that is a reasonable strategy. I would mention to that patient, you know, just so you know, untreated pain is also a risk factor for relapse. So I need you to let me know if you feel like your level of pain, you know, you're tempted to return to your sort of substance of misuse of choice.
Ruth Kaufman from the Netherlands in Europe. I was wondering if there are hospital guidelines or do you have national guidelines for pain management? And commenting on the presentation on geriatric patients, in Europe we have the tendency not to use Tramadol and we check the kidney function in all patients. I was wondering, could you comment on that, please?
I think from a Tramadol standpoint, we do use it. I think the risks are poorly understood and not yet well-defined, so I think it's something we need to explore more. We do have hospital guidelines now since February for all surgical patients across every specialty. They're specialty-specific and procedure-specific. They're not for every procedure yet for how much to prescribe. I think the national guidelines is actually a big problem in the U.S. because they're a one-size-fits-all approach that are very absolute and don't apply to unique circumstances and don't apply to certain surgeries. They are kind of across-the-board cutoffs, and I think that's a big issue that we need to work on as a group, you know, developing our own guidelines that are appropriate and not having these national guidelines take effect. So I think that's a problem we need to work on. I don't know what the panel thinks about Tramadol or guidelines.
Yeah, so I think Tramadol it's a reasonable option in the elderly individuals, but I think the thing, it was already discussed, I think Tramadol has been one of those things that's just kind of crept up through the back door that people have not really recognized it is an opioid. And so you have to keep that in mind when you are prescribing it. And for the elderly individuals, considering renal function, considering liver function, other comorbidities is an important component. And getting your pharmacist involved as necessary to help you dose some of these drugs when necessary.
The reason why we don't use Tramadol is we saw an increase in delirium in elderly.
Delirium.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we have the tendency to use very low doses of oxycodone instead because of the risk of delirium is smaller in oxycodone, as we saw in our hospitals, than in Tramadol.
Sure. Yeah. So you have the same risks. They're present for Tramadol as associated with any of the other opioids. And so yes, you may see a little change in the prevalence depending upon the dosage and the usage, but again, it's in the same kind of category of opioids that I would consider for moderate pain for any of our elderly folks. And then, lastly, from the guideline standpoint, you know, I think one of the exciting things is that people are looking at this stuff now, and you know, whether it's guidelines or whether it's just data that's coming out from studies performed here. In the U.S., when you look at studies looking at, you know, the routine inguinal hernia or lap chole or appy or whatever breast surgery, and recognizing the typical or the median or mean duration of therapy with opioids, having that data now can help guide you in your prescription and in setting the expectations with the patients. And that's wonderful to have because historically, you know, again, it was the knee-jerk, I'm going to give everybody 30 Percocets and hope that they don't show up until 2 weeks later. And that's the wrong approach. And so I think we've become much more sophisticated now that we have data and then some guidelines to help guide us as we move through.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. Thank you for a great second half.
Adrian Kant, General Surgery in Westchester, New York. I'm sorry, my voice is a little bit down. Couple of quick comments and a question as well. Somebody asked about heparin and use of the NSAIDs and everything. I've always personally believed that neither of those cause bleeding, although they certainly have the potential to, you know, increase the likelihood of bleeding that is occurring, you know, to go on. So if you get a drain in place or something, I know breast surgeons in particular, in one of my older hospitals, were a little more wary of using NSAIDs of any kind, but I haven't had any problem at all with that, just to lay that out there. The question that was raised as to Toradol, Ketorolac, and being able to use those, question, I know the marketing materials, for instance, for ibuprofen, Caldolor, had come out and talked about them having a lower side effect profile, less effect on kidney function, GIs, and things like that. And I know that frequently they're used interchangeably. I'm not sure if anyone in the panel can comment on whether they really are, whether there are advantages or disadvantages to either or. I personally tend to use the Caldolor, potentially both pre-op in the holding area for simple elective surgeries, a gallbladder or hernia, something like that, to kind of head off that post-op need, as well as using it now standing for easy conversion to PO ibuprofen in the same doses in my post-op patients as a standing dose. Just curious if you can comment on that.
I don't have experience with it, so I don't know if any of the other panelists do. I'll take a look at that, though. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry.
I just want to ask, I appreciate the question from the gentleman about substance abuse. Aside from an emergency operation or a cancer operation or even taking those patients to the operating room or putting them to sleep in regards to their risk of relapse or exacerbating something that's already going on.
Can you say that one more time?
I was saying I presume he was talking about emergency operations because electively I'm not sure I would want to take that person to the operating room or if I were anesthesia, put them to sleep if I didn't somehow have to. And I'm just wondering if you all are commonly I don't see a whole lot of patients or substance.
A difference between someone who's actively using and someone with a
somebody on a maintenance program. You know, from an anesthetic standpoint, I don't worry about putting them to sleep. And, you know, we have lots of other agents besides opioids to help people stay asleep. So that's not a challenge from that standpoint. When you talk about that combination for perioperative pain control, then the equation changes. But in terms of the intraoperative anesthetic, it's just something I need to be aware of, and it's going to be fine from a general anesthetic standpoint.
I think you've got other health risks related to other illicit substance use, so I would say, you know, be quick to do a Utox on anybody that's sort of has any chemical coping type history, because if you've got somebody that's got cocaine in their system, you know, you're going to make a different choice about anesthesia and timing of surgery. It's, again, a sort of a fine line, because you also don't want to be kind of discriminating against patients who have a non-active substance use history and not be offering them elective surgery that may, you know, benefit their overall health or their quality of life, et cetera. So I think you have to distinguish between, you know, active use and non-active historical use.
And the volume of patients we're going to see on this is going to go up. So there's a heavy promotion for what they call MAT or medication-assisted treatment that can either be a buprenorphine, naloxone-containing product, or can be Vivitrol, which is just a pure opioid antagonist. So you're going to see more and more people who are going to come in for elective procedures who are on MAT. So it's just going to be something that we have to figure out good ways to approach, have honest conversations ahead of time, set expectations, and then manage them in a systematic fashion afterwards.
I was just going to say one other thing about methadone. I think that's the exception to the recommendation that I made to try to be consistent in using the same opioid that somebody's on. So, you know, in the palliative care world, we'll sometimes use methadone for pain control, particularly in patients with the opioid use history, more kind of in a palliative or end-of-life setting. But I would say in general, unless anyone disagrees, we should not be using methadone as a short-acting postoperative acute pain medication. It's just too complicated with the half-life. The duration of action for pain control is shorter than the duration of action for opioid craving suppression, and it's just too complicated. So in that case, feel free to introduce a different opioid because it's safer.
And then the question about, you know, an emergency operation versus an elective operation, ultimately you're trying to optimize your patient, right? You're trying to get them smoking, for instance. Yeah, it would be great if every patient I did Whipple on stopped smoking a month in advance. It's not going to happen. Now, if I'm doing transplant surgery and there's organ allocation, then a patient has to be clean for a period of time or they're not going to get that organ. That's a different scenario. So we just try to optimize the patient. And the line is, ultimately, if you give an artist a beat-up canvas, you're not going to get as much of a masterpiece out of it, and you do the best you can. There are going to be contraindications where you're going to say, no, can't do surgery in this situation, but for the most part, you're optimizing them.
I think it's a comorbidity. If you think of it as a comorbidity, like anything else, either even a historical substance use history, you know, do you optimize it the best you can, and then do the additional risks offered by that comorbidity outweigh, you know, the benefits of the surgery or not?
I think we have time for three more quick questions, and then there can always be some questions at the end after.
Scott Grant from New York. Thank you very much for the panel. I was going to ask about the use of ice packs. So in my practice, I've historically only used them, you know, after inguinal hernia repair, but it sounds like a lot of you are using them more frequently than that. Is there any data about that, whether it has any effects on surgical site infections? I know that some people also use heat. Do you have any comparative data or any info on that? And also, I guess, are you using it only for laparotomies, or would you use it even for something like a lap chole at the embolicus or a neck surgery?
So our institution, we did a randomized trial. Viraj Master is a senior author. He's a urologist who does big cable thrombectomies and renal cell carcinoma. And so he engaged all of us who do big abdominal cancer surgery and elective non-cancer surgery as well to do a randomized trial of ice packs, 24-hour administration. And there was a reduction in the two cohorts, and 75 patients or so in each group, of about a day use of opioids. So we've started doing it. All our residents do it. So now it's just routine. They go on in the recovery room. There are some patients who are going to have some cold intolerance who aren't going to want it, and you do the best you can. Every therapy that we have has a failure rate. But it seems to work pretty well. It costs about $5, and so try it out.
I know there's an article, and I've got it bookmarked. I haven't read it yet, but does anybody have any experience with liposomal bupivacaine epidurals? And then the second part of this question is, do you find the tap block helps with his upper abdominal incisions? Because it seems like our anesthesiologist could go right at the embolicus and gets everything low. That's right.
You want to talk about
that? So liposomal bupivacaine right now is not approved for epidural use, right? So probably shouldn't be doing it to your unsuspecting public. As far as the tap blocks, they're location, location, location. So if you move up, you're going to change the distribution of the local anesthetic. So if you're only going at one place and you're missing certain areas, talk with them about changing it. There are a lot of other blocks that people are working on right now besides tap blocks that work in similar planes and may have better spread. You'll hear a lot of talk about quadratus lumborum blocks or QL blocks. So people are doing blocks in different fascial planes with ultrasound that can also provide better coverage. And if it really is upper abdominal and you're really having bad coverage, they may move to something like a paravertebral block that's going to be a lot more reliable than coming all the way around.
I was doing them myself, you know, with the incision open at the end of the case and administering a total volume of 25 cc's on either side with the addition of a little dexamethasone and bupivacaine, and then I started using the liposomal. In my hospital, it's a real big battle with pharmacy about the expense, quite frankly, and they have said that they don't see the value, and so therefore they, but it's come around. We go back and forth on that. And then I decided that I was really interested in seeing the value of preemptive analgesia and actually doing the tap block sets. Now I have my anesthesia. As soon as the patient goes to sleep, takes them a few minutes. They have everything mixed up. They administer it. We talk about where the incision's going to be so that they have some idea. And we go, and we even do it for our minimally invasive cases as well.
We do it, most of our major abdominal case, most of the residents do it at the beginning of the case, ultrasound guided, and we actually do a rectus block, a high block with that. So you do it in two locations. You go as high as you can laterally, and then one more rectus block. It's really pretty easy under ultrasound guidance, and yeah, it seems to work pretty well. We haven't done a randomized trial with that.
Obese patients, there may be an issue, like morbidly obese patients, they may struggle with that. What's that? We don't do those. No, I'm just kidding. It's rare that we use a chevron incision, but you know, you do the best you can. And then if it's going to be very difficult, an epidural is always an option as well.
One last question, and we'll have to end it.
All right. Brandon Bacon from Kansas City. Thank you all for your preparation on the last lecture, the last day. I'm always fascinated by the psychology of pain and the perception thereof, and I was wondering if you have any thoughts on focusing on surreptitious assessment of pain and using objective data as opposed to asking patients every 4 hours, how's your pain, and causing them to perseverate on that. Is there any benefit to trying to do something like that, getting them away from focusing on it all the time?
Pet therapy seems to work pretty well to distract people. It's one option.
If you would have seen me 15 years ago, I was not asking pain scores then either. So throughout my career, I have not believed that it's been a useful tool. So watching people is always helpful. Looking to see what they look like or what they're doing before you walk in the room. We heard a comment before about the person who's sitting up in bed watching TV laughing at a bad show, right? You know they're doing okay. And I will ask people, have you been up out of bed? Have you walked today, right? What else have you been doing? Have you seen the physical therapist? I want to ask as many other things that are function related as possible. And I will never come in and ask you your pain score. And over the years in the chronic pain setting, I joke or I tease with people, right? So we get lots of people that come in and say, my pain score is a 25, right? So I've developed a response to that. I tell them, listen, you have to work with me. You only have $10 to spend. If you spend more than $10, you create a pain debt. I'm going to come to your house and hurt you later, okay? So, just to get around this whole score thing, it really is, look, watch what they're doing. Just go in and have a conversation with them and say, can they talk in a complete sentence? Are they moving around the bed? Do they look like they're in horrible pain? And so this surreptitious observation is something that I think is critically important.
All right. Thank you very much.